This is the city. People live here. People play here. They work here. And people die here. City planners try to envision the modern meccas of the future as they destroy some of the slums of the past and try to create out of America's crowded, teeming slums future marvelous places for additional millions of people to live. The things that attract people to the cities are not the riots, not the burning buildings, but the theater marquees, the promise of a good life, the better job, the easy access via the freeway from one's home in the suburbs to the downtown area where, amidst Skid Row, amidst all the pawn shops, and if you can find that place, in the middle of all the signs is a high-rise building where you might find a job that will give you the kind of a wage, that will give you the kind of a life you came to the city to find. It's beautiful in cities. The theater marquees are beautiful. Aircraft, traffic, new automobiles with big engines, with hundreds of horsepower that go at 12 miles an hour, and all the signs and the sounds and the crowded, enervating conditions in a city drive you so crazy sometimes you just want to say, why can't we stop it all and make it go away? Well, we can't. It's quite a story what cities are doing to us, and better yet, it's quite a story what we are doing to cities. And Uncle Sam is only as healthy as are his cities. Our cities are places that are increasingly becoming sick. And that means that Uncle Sam is also sick. If you're the member of a very close family and old Uncle Sam is a member of your family, he's someone that you all know and love, and the old boy's step is beginning to falter a good bit. His breath comes a little slow. He gasps and has a kind of a rattle in his chest. He's about 87, or maybe he's crowding 90, still chews now and then. Maybe he smokes a pack a day, but he's just living proof that cigarette ads aren't even, you know, in the little box in the corner, what they really say they are, that even though the Surgeon General thinks they're dangerous to your health, old Uncle Sam's been smoking all his life, and he ain't dead yet, as the Tex Williams song went. But if you were a close-knit member of a family that had an old Uncle Sam, and he had a few liver spots, kind of a bad color, his hair was long gone, and he kind of crept around, wasn't quite what he used to be, and you didn't really know what his condition was, maybe you would be concerned enough, if you really did love the old boy, to take him down to the local physician, a specialist, if you can find a good doctor, and we all know there aren't any bad ones. Well, then you would have him given a complete physical checkup. Now, maybe they would tell you that he's got a little bit of a cholesterol problem, he's got a little bit of a heart problem, his liver is not active the way it should be, a little bit of a kidney problem. He probably couldn't run up too much of a flight of steps without keeling over with a heart attack. But you might say, well, his eyes are weak, but he still sees pretty good. His hearing is a little hard of hearing now. He has to say, eh, say that again every now and then. But I mean, for a guy his age, he's not as bad as he could be. Now, maybe that's not a fair analogy, you know, to take an entire nation like the United States of America and draw the analogy from head to toe of a physical system. The head, the skeletal system, the muscular system, the digestive system, the nervous system, the various systems of a human body, and just to draw the analogy of what is wrong with us from head to foot and ask and answer the question, is Uncle Sam as well as he should be? Or is he getting a little bit sick? But it's only a few, we say. They are doing it to us. They are the people. Well, it depends on who you're talking to. They, if you are a racist who thinks that the Jewish people are guilty for it all, are the Jewish bankers. That's what some people say. Or they are the racist bigots. And the same people might make that comment, which is a little bit ridiculous when you stop to think about it. They are the CIA, the federal government, or the communists, or the mafia, and organized crime. Or they're the hippies and the youth. Or they are the jobless and the people on the dole, or virtually a dole, food stamps. the poverty program. People who have a job resent those who don't, and vice versa. They are always that unknown quantity of someone else who is ruining the country. They're ruining the country, screams the indignant fellow in the middle of the lake with a rod in his hand fishing for bass as he throws an empty beer can in the bottom of the lake. We don't like to be told that Uncle Sam is sick. We like to cop out by saying it's only a few people. It's the drug pushers. It's those dirty criminals out there. It's corrupt politicians in huge bureaucratic segments of government. Or it's the CIA, or it's the establishment. Whatever it is, we're sure that there is a small group of people somewhere, whatever their labels, who are ruining the country. But we don't like to be told that maybe we are ruining our country, collectively, all of us, a little bit at a time, slowly, insistently, continuously, on a day-to-day and a week-to-week basis, we are ruining our country. We don't like to be told that, but it is the truth. You know, long, long ago, there was a sage prophet whose name was Isaiah, a very patriotic man, deeply concerned about his people during that day, who had been told to carry, by way of commission, a very shocking message to the leadership and to the people of his country. He wrote that message, and believe it or not, it is vividly alive for us right now today. It's a book of your Bible called the Book of Isaiah. In the very first chapter, he draws a similar analogy. He talked about people then who were just ignorant. He said, an ox knows his crib, an ass or a jackass knows how to walk into his own barn. They seemed to recognize their leader, their master, but God's people didn't know their own God. So he said in verse 4, that first chapter of this very, very shocking document, when you read the analogy, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken the eternal. They provoke the Holy One of Israel into anger." Then he said in verse 5, "Why should you be stricken anymore? You will just revolt more and more. The whole head is sick and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot, even under the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment." For the sake of the analogy that I have drawn, as Isaiah drew the analogy of a sick people from head to foot, I said that the skeletal framework, the very building blocks of the nation, would be, in my analogy — you could make any analogy you would like, any way you would like to, maybe there are various different ways in which we could draw the analogy, and many of these points might overlap — but I said that the skeletal framework would be the Founding Fathers' ideals, the very documents upon which our free society is based. We looked into that and we saw that today, in the modern 1970s, we still have not realized the dreams of our Founding Fathers. The muscular system, the muscle of a nation, I said, would be its 25 to 44-year-old labor force, its gross national product. That laboring class of people who have produced the most dizzying array of gross national product, the flow of goods and services, in the history of any nation on the face of the earth. The circulatory system that feeds those muscles — well, many analogies again you could draw, but to me it was the flow of those goods and services. Not only communications, but the postal service, for example. The flow through our railways, our canals, our rivers, our trucking lines and bus lines, our automobiles and airplanes, the flow of foods, of oil, of fuel, of manufactured commodities and goods, the flow even of people. As we looked at each one of these portions of a physical body by way of analogy, we saw certain very important sicknesses, certain debilities in the skeletal framework, a bone disease. In the muscular system, flaccid, flabby muscles, too much fat, too much lard, and poor circulation, and lots of potential for disease. In the circulatory system itself, we saw a clogged system, one that virtually threatens to break down, one that is in severe trouble everywhere. And we saw in the last couple of programs that, yes, whether we like to admit it or not, Uncle Sam is indeed a little bit sick. Oh, there's a lot of life in the old boy yet, but he's not as healthy as he ought to be.
The mighty Roman Empire had everything. Plenty of leisure time. Their own new morality. Enormous military might. The religion of their choice. Political freedom.
Binoculus, Populus, Quae Roman.
What went wrong? Read The Modern Romans, a 93-page lesson of history ignored. For your free copy of The Modern Romans, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. The Modern Romans asks, can we afford the grandeur of Rome?
There's a lot of life in the old boy yet. He's not past some kind of emergency treatment, even if it implies an operation. But when you look at old Uncle Sam, if you're really concerned, if you're really, really worried about him, I don't think it's either unpatriotic or dangerous or wrong thinking to acknowledge that there are many areas in our society that are just about ready to break down. Now, we've only begun to scratch the surface. We haven't even gotten to some of the vital organs and some of the other areas that could cause death immediately. I haven't even gotten, by way of analogy, a lung system, let's say, just to talk about the respiratory tract by itself. We're talking about the digestive system in this program now. I've covered the rest of that. And as you come to that, you begin to realize that we are not a consumer society. We don't completely devour or consume that which we produce. Maybe it's a good thing. To me, the digestive system would be the total maw of the city that gobbles up the combined gross national product of this fantastic country of ours like a voracious, gargantuan, giant, iron-toothed maw, gobbling up the landscape, the farmland, and the acreages to the tune of hundreds of thousands of square miles. When you begin to think it's that much, it isn't, of course. Don't quote me on that. But when you look at the tremendous asphalt, concrete jungles, we are still the modern cliff dwellers. We have created for ourselves canyons, and we've gone down in those dark canyons to live. And then we take elevators up there to our little cubicle, and we think this is good. This is the good life. To me, a city is like a giant stomach reaching out to devour the combined resources, the natural minerals, and the raw materials of a land, and in turn, pouring its pollutions and effluent into the air, into the streams and rivers, and on the highways, and carrying out of the cities and dumping it somewhere. A tremendous, giant, teeming, steeping, festering sore that is a city, with a lot of clanging noise and smoke belching into the air to make it ever the more unpleasant. As you look at our ports, our cities with their giant skyscrapers, and at the tremendous flow of life in the United States, our circulatory system and our digestive and excretory system, I would say that we're pretty well on the way toward total blockage. In other words, we're irregular. Today, you can buy a giant automobile. It's very wide. It leaves a real wide track, they claim. And it's got an engine that's probably several hundred horsepower. But don't worry, you're not going to get all that horsepower out of it. And if you could, you couldn't go anywhere because you can only average about 5 miles an hour in peak rush hour traffic across midtown Manhattan. And about the same in a lot of America's big cities, maybe less on some occasions, maybe slightly more on others. Back in 1912, you could make it at about 12 miles an hour behind a horse in downtown New York City. But today, you move along much more slowly than that. There are solutions to such problems as the automobile and its pollutants. There really are, but we're not going to accept those. Automobiles could be limited in size, they could be limited with regard to their horsepower, and it doesn't make sense to me. Now, I am not an automotive genius. As a matter of fact, I'm not even an automotive mechanic. I am not even an automotive engineer. But it doesn't seem to make sense to me that with our anti-pollution devices on modern-day automobiles burning you're getting six miles to the gallon in an economy car. Now, this is a fact that I have an absolute proof of. I'm getting 8 miles to the gallon with the van that I have and a smog device on it. You have to go now, you know, to certified agencies or garages to get that thing checked before you can get your license in the state of California every single year. So I have an anti-pollution device where they lock this thing in so you can't change it when you go up into the mountains or you come back into a lower area. I think we could solve those problems. I think it makes sense to go back a few years in time and to ask ourselves, how could you solve the problem of just the pollution from an automobile by itself? Well, first, their size could be limited. The horsepower could be limited. The very size of the engine could be so governed or limited that we would devour much less fuel. But that would take a complete different system, a complete different kind of an economic system, and a complete different governmental system than we have today. To say that we're going to get this done today, no matter how logical or how rational it may appear, to solve the overcrowding problem would be insanity. We can't do it, and we're not doing it. You know, automobiles could have several different instruments they don't have today. They could have a tachometer. That isn't the way to pronounce that. But they could give us an RPM gauge. They could give us a mixture level, just like an airplane might have, so that you could lean out a carburetor. You know, you can go up to a carburetor and adjust it. Mechanics can adjust the timing just by turning a little set screw. Well, now, why not have a lever inside the automobile where you could do that inside the car? And what about these automatic chokes? Is it too much work to have a manual choke lever so that on cold winter mornings you could choke the car a little bit to get it started and adjust it as you wanted to? If we went back in time to the old original automobiles with more manual controls of what they called spark and also the mixture that they had, we could be burning far less fuel. I don't know, maybe I'm crazy, but to me it doesn't make sense to get 6 miles to the gallon and claim that you are not polluting on a 22-gallon tank of gas where you used to get maybe 13 or 14. It seems to me like the further you go on the less fuel you burn, well, then the less residual pollutants you're putting in the air. The less unburned raw vapor goes into the air. Now, maybe I'm crazy. I guess I don't understand how it is they can put anti-smog devices on automobiles and chop the mileage just about in half. But that's what's happening, and you know it if you've got one of those on your car, and I know it. And yet your car might be rated at 285 horsepower. You don't need all of that because you were going just about as fast a year or so ago with one that was rated at about half of that, or about 10 years or so ago, and you'd have to go that far back to where you could get them rated at about half that. Cities. To me, they are places that are virtually uninhabitable. As we reflect on America's cities, at the problems of our crowded, teeming centers of population, it's time to ask, is this really the good life? Millions of us are coming and going back and forth, coming to a city for the good life, and then trying to escape the city via the airways because of the bad life we found there. And what that does to us in terms of pollution, that smarts and stings and burns our eyes as we send up into the skies over America in terms of tonnage of pollutants and particulate matter. More tonnage of smog and air pollution than we produce in tonnage of steel. And yet this is supposed to be where we find the good life. We go back and forth in our automobiles at frantic speeds on the freeways, to our jobs or to our homes, battling one another in an exhausting, enervating condition of life that would drive an animal completely insane, and sometimes does. And all of this because this is where the good life is found. Our gross national product looks so beautiful, displayed to us in television ads of people coming ashore in the shrimp boat and throwing a can of beer to you right straight out of a big bucket full of ice cubes. But doesn't it look silly when it is on the junk pile, or it's wafting in the sludge and the mud alongside an ocean liner at a dock where the wharf rats lurk at night? Doesn't it look silly to see all of the pouring excretia of all of our civilization polluting the landscapes, sudsing in the streams just like Mrs. Housewife Fawcett can in her own sink sometimes? And in our mad search for more power, more oil, more fossil fuels, by which we can continue these energy slaves and keep these energy sources going. Once in a while, an offshore drilling rig springs a leak, as happened off the coast of California on a couple of occasions, as happens once in a while off the Gulf Coast, and you know the rest of the story, wildlife suffers. Well, are these creatures beginning to tell us something? Is there some warning in the inability of creatures that live with us in our narrow biosphere on this good green earth as they strangle and die? Are these alarming signs that we ought to pay heed to in the United States of America? Pollution is not just something to beat over the head as an issue that came to great attention for a very short period of time. Now we can forget about, because surely everybody knows about pollution and surely everybody is doing something about it. I just came back from a very quick trip that was a very fine break for me, at least, and saw some people that watched television in the Shreveport area. This was down at Toledo Bend on the border between Louisiana and Texas. And the bass were hitting over there, but I'll tell you, we would get back in some of those, as they call them, necks or coves on that lake, and you'd see the beer cans floating here and there, and you drive around some of those roads and the borders of those two states over there, and I'm here to tell you it's the truth, so if anybody thinks I'm picking on them, they may think what they like, but it looks to me like people over in that part of the country, and I don't want to just pick on one part of the country, because I've seen it, whether you're talking about Minnesota or Oregon, or whether you're talking about Ohio to Florida, and recently when I was down for a personal appearance in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, I couldn't believe my eyes at the incredible mountains of just plain garbage and trash that people are dumping over somebody else's back fence. But here was this area where the potential is enormous for absolute beauty, breathtaking beauty. But everywhere you look, you see nothing but trash and garbage, and I mean people don't even bother getting off the main road. They pull over with their automobile and they just throw it. One of these days, if we ever get a portable VTR, a videotape recorder, then in some of these areas where you start sounding off about the way things are, maybe we'll just take you there right quickly and show you. So no matter where you live in Middle America or in Canada or someplace else, you won't say, oh, Garner Ted's just sounding off about conditions again and picking on one part of the country. I have never been in a trashier part of the country in my life unless it's somewhere in the center of Los Angeles.
Can be reversed if it's taken seriously. Learn the true scope of the problem and what else you can do. Send for your free copy of Our Polluted Planet. Write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
When you talk about cities, you have to talk about all that cities mean to us. That means America's big port cities. It means the flow of traffic into and out of those cities. It means the gobbling up of landscape by the fantastic urban renewal. Not urban renewal so much as just the development of suburban areas. But the antiquated, slow-moving city governments that usually always are trying to improvise after the problems have already struck, that are unable to see in advance and that are always so underfunded because of vitally needed city services and so on. You know, what's happening in many of our cities is merely that some of the old racial areas are breaking down. The areas in Chicago, New York, and Detroit, and some of the western cities even have had certain ghetto areas, but not quite so extensive as in the east. And the neighborhoods are changing. They're in a state of constant flux. So as you had in a matter of 1 year or so, the total racial complexion of a certain neighborhood in the city, that changes dramatically. What has been happening in America's big cities, and this is true of practically all of them, is the fleeing of the middle-class white family to the suburbs. Now what that has done is to create vast areas of impoverished ethnic groups in what used to be predominantly middle-class white areas inside the city. And it's also caused a dramatic shifting of the tax base to give that city government the money by which to sponsor various programs for urban renewal or development or the destruction of old blighted ghetto areas and so on. So it's a kind of a vicious circle. Now, talking about cities, of course, deserves about 10 programs, and I couldn't even cover it then. The crowded conditions, buildings jammed together, vehicle traffic, crime, pornography, the very changing of the shape of the landscape itself, the changing of architectural design and concepts of apartment houses and of private living, the disappearance of natural beauty, the gobbling up of farmland, living where the crops ought to be grown, and then going out and trying to farm the desert, which is what they do in Southern California. Transportation chaos, the massive traffic jams, the snail-paced downtown traffic, traffic, the giving over to vast areas of the inner urban areas of big cities to the automobile. In the Los Angeles area, for example, it's somewhere now close to 50%. And you can look, as I do once in a while, from the air at cities, and you will see buildings emerging out of these vast parking lots. Well, thankfully, it's getting to be a little easier to find a parking place in some cities because finally they're trying to plan for it. Airspace over cities is jammed and crowded, and ATC people, air traffic controllers, sometimes must have nearly a heart attack in trying to keep pace with the crowded skies, the conditions of the fantastic levels of air traffic these days that clog even airspace. Whether you're talking then about automobiles, buses, rapid transit problems, this is an agony of nearly all big cities today, the overcrowded conditions, airspace, crime, whether you're talking about drugs, whether you're talking about the explosive conditions in some of the big universities, whether you're talking about racism in the ghettos, or whether you're talking about the health-destroying properties of cities, the pollution of air, the pollution, solid pollution, the massive amounts of garbage and trash that litters, the noise pollution that enervates and exhausts and futilizes people, the water shortages, the fuel shortages, the increased and tremendous vulnerability of America's big cities that can be brought to a screeching standstill by a sudden change of the weather, by a fuel shortage, by a power blackout, by so many seemingly simple things that can happen to virtually bring city life to a halt. A 22-year-old social worker pretty much epitomized what a lot of people think about cities by saying, a city makes you hard. You begin to have to develop a kind of a crust in order to survive. A secretary said it makes you self-centered. You forget about other people and you focus on yourself. Care, concern for others is pushed aside as millions flock to the big city and the hustle and the bustle of city life that we call the good life. No, cities are clogged, and if you look at this analogy, as I'm saying, from head to foot of Uncle Sam, and if you talk about the circulatory system and the flow of, well, all of the excrement, of getting rid of all of the trash of society, you've got to say that Uncle Sam has a terrible congestion problem. Some people might even call it by an unpleasant word. Write for the booklets we've talked about, The Modern Romans and the one on pollution. They're free of charge, no price at all. Be sure to tell us the call letters or the station channel numbers of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong. See you later.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, BC.